Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about chocolate. Two different studies showing it improves two things in our body that we all need, and how dwelling on stressful events can increase inflammation. And vitamin D, helping African Americans lower their blood pressure, and a whole lot more, all from mainstream peer-reviewed journals. Then we're going to take a look at some social issues. For example, Snowden is going to say that Facebook is a surveillance company branded as social media. It's a three-minute comment. Boy, it's important. We're in-depth about Monsanto's weed killer. Is it killing humans? Well, some of us are going to share that with you. And also, in my opinion, the finest, most authentic journalist in the world, John Pilger, is going to talk about how World War III is already underway. And then what we didn't get to yesterday was about a five-minute clip about what our Ivy League education is doing to students. He says, you become excellent sheep. Well, we hear what this professor has to say on that. And then some of the people might have heard of Alex Jones. He's a firebrand. On some issues, he's actually correct, but he tends to be extremely volatile in his emotions. But he was a big supporter of President Trump, and it continues to be a big supporter of President Trump, and talked at some point about how Trump would call him and get advice. And it is supposed to be around 2.5 million people following Alex Jones. And those people were supposed to have voted for Trump. Well, that's a big impact. But then he went on the air live right after the bombing in Syria, and which he ended up supporting Trump in. But before live, in one of those rare moments, he was told he had 5 minutes before live time, and he let out some expletives about President Trump. Whoa. And then at the end, when someone told him there might have been a little stream, he said, well, get that and edit it, delete it. Too late. We have it. We're going to play it. Why? Normally, I wouldn't do this. But if you're saying one thing about a person, and that's what you really feel, then a minute later, I don't think it begs the question of authenticity and genuineness when you completely reverse yourself. We'll hear, what does he really think of President Trump and bombing Syria, the liberal community? So he's into a rant mood. We'll see what we can learn from that. And because a lot of people are following him. We're also going to be taking calls later in the program. I'm intentionally not this week, except for tonight's show on the Progressive Commentary, because I want to have more time for people to have a chance to call in. And I didn't have a chance yesterday, but I will to. Let us begin with the latest on health and healing. We know we should be getting vitamin D, but African Americans are not getting enough in the sun because of melanin in their skin is blocking a lot of it being properly absorbed and metabolized. But the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension says African Americans need to reduce significantly their blood pressure, and vitamin D can do that. Now, this was a prospective trial, a three-month regimen of daily vitamin D increased circulating blood levels of vitamin D and resulted in a decrease in systolic blood pressure, and that was substantial. And systolic blood pressure, by the way, is the top and highest number in a reading. And it's the pressure in the arteries when the heart beats. And diastolic blood pressure, which is the bottom and lower number, is pressure in the arteries between heartbeats. And African Americans have higher rates of hypertension and lower levels of circulating the hydroxy vitamin D3 than the rest of the U.S. population. And so it's saying that 1,000 units, which in my opinion is too low, I would have gone double that, would have substantially reduced over 3 months the blood pressure. Even getting 4,000 units would even do more. So they were taking either placebo or they were taking vitamin D, and those that took vitamin D had a big drop in their blood pressure. That's good. All of us are faced with stress of different types, and sometimes we have a break. Sometimes we can go a day, a week, a month without having something really stressful. But since life is always changing and on a step forward to the next adventure, we're going to be faced some form of stress. When we move, change jobs, have a divorce or a separation, when we have a loss, all of these create stress. This study, as given in Science Daily and done at Ohio State University, shows that dwelling on stressful events can increase inflammation in the body. Now, that's bad. Why? Because when you continue dwelling on anything that's stressful, you increase inflammatory markers in the body, including C-reactive protein, a marker of tissue inflammation that can directly hurt the heart. In fact, when that's up, you're more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke. And the research team recruited young, healthy women to participate in the project. And then those women who could not give up on their stress or focusing upon it had substantially higher inflammatory markers 1 hour after thinking about anything stressful. So what it means is this: you have a thought now that's stressful, and your blood chemistry is going to change and stay changed for hours afterwards. Okay, that's assuming you only have one stressful thought that day. What if you have a stressful thought and you carry it through the day? Well, then you're putting yourself in harm's way for a heart attack or stroke all day long. So that's important. Chocolate, if it's organic chocolate and hopefully fair trade, it enhances visual performance. It improves your eyesight. Now, all of us know that beta-carotene contained in carrots that makes the vegetable a powerful food for your eyes. But most people are not aware that chocolate does the same thing. And so this is just one more of the many things that chocolate does that's good. This was researched at the University of Reading in England, and they found that those that received chocolate had an improvement in vision tests, better than before the test, and better than the other participants who received a placebo chocolate. Their findings were published in Physiology and Behavior. So my suggestion, 2 ounces of a dark chocolate, 60% cacao or higher, would be fine. The higher, the more bitter the chocolate, but the better it is for you. A separate study shows that eating some chocolate could treat acute and chronic cough. And there were British National Health Service presented the findings of their study at the British Thoracic Society meeting, talking about they looked at 13 different United Kingdom hospitals where patients suffering from cough, and they said those that had some chocolate did the best. So if you have a chronic cough or an acute cough, try 2 ounces again of chocolate or chocolate into a smoothie and drink it the day. Something else is good for you is seaweed. We just don't need enough of it. And most people never eat any of it. But seaweed extract outperforms chemotherapy in shrinking tumors, but with no toxic side effects. That's correct. According to Natural News, the extract of an edible red seaweed was found to be 27% more effective than a standard chemo drug in shrinking breast tumors in this. So with toxicity, nothing to the liver, the kidneys, and even improving antioxidant status in the blood and tissue. So the seaweed used in this remarkable study, let me spell it for you. U-E-S, excuse me, E-U-C-H. EUMA. Second World, COTTONII. It's an edible, tropical red seaweed which grows naturally within about 20 degrees of the equator and is most commonly found around Southeast Asia, but you can get it in the United States and Canada. And we've known that this group of seaweeds is widely farmed for the use and production. And so you can get it. It's available. You can even get it online. But just think for a moment. 27% more effective than chemo and improving antioxidant status and having no harmful side effects? Wow. In my studies over the years, I've always looked at what in a given society have they used. That's where I first found out about curcumin or turmeric being used in Indian cuisine, for example, and how fermented foods were used in Chinese and Japanese societies to great benefit. Later, scientific research was done that posited that these were accurate, meaning what had been traditional wisdom was scientifically verified. So various seaweeds have been used for centuries in China and Japanese traditional medical culture for breast cancer. And epidemiological studies have also shown that daily seaweed consumption dramatically lower breast cancer risk, and is considered one of the reasons why Japanese women have 83% less breast cancer than those in the West. And that's important. In fact, more recently, a clinical trial in the United States showed that just 5 grams per day of dried seaweed, and the seaweed they use is Undaria, U-N-D-A-R-I-A, decreased levels of a key pro-cancer protein, the UPAR, by 47% in postmenopausal women. Again, that spelling of the seaweed is U-N-A-R-I-A. So this new study provides yet more good science to the case for using seaweed against breast cancer. And one of the ways I make seaweed and have it at least every other day is I drain and rinse seaweed 3 times. Then I heat it at a low temperature and let it steep for about 10 minutes. Turn off the water. Then I blanch it, meaning I pour cold water over it. And then I drain it, and then I put it in the fridge. But I don't put it in alone. I put horseradish, mustard, some manuka honey, and whatever seasonings that I have, stir that up. And then when I have a salad, I can take an avocado and then stuff the seaweed in the avocado and then drizzle olive oil over it and with some pepper, which is good for you, and Himalayan sea salt. And you have a delicious lunch as a seaweed stuffed into avocado and on a plate of sprouts. Great meal. All right, also a new study from Professor Carl Grossman, who we've had on this program many times, and he published an article in Global Research, one of the finest publications out there. And it shows now that when you look at all of the research on how many people actually died at Chernobyl, 985,000. Almost 1 million people died because of Chernobyl and mainly from cancer. So someone should inform those who want to downplay the dangers of nuclear power that the science is in on this. And radioactive poison sent billowing from the plant into the air included cesium-137 and iodine-131 and strontium-90. And people in not just Ukraine, but Belarus and Russia, Bulgaria, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Poland, Sweden, and the United Kingdom all had measurable increases of the poisons that spewed forth that over those weeks from Chernobyl. So, in fact, even North Africa was hit with more than a 5% of the Chernobyl releases. So, one more reason why we should decommission all of these plants out there. And because you can see hot spots of cancer, especially breast cancer and thyroid cancer, around a plant until the plant closes. And then you see this precipitous drop in the incidence of these cancers. And finally, there is a new study presented in the Cancer Epidemiology and Biomarkers, presented by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, that a vegetarian and vegan diets protect against cancers. That's correct. Vegetarian and vegan diets protect against cancer compared with non-vegetarian diets, according to the American Association of Cancer Research. They analyzed 69,120 participants as part of the Adventist Health Study 2 and found that beyond the reduced risk of overall cancer, vegetarian and vegan diets significantly reduced the risk of gastrointestinal cancers, stomach, colon, and pancreas, and female-specific cancer, breast and ovarian, respectively. So that's important and extremely relevant today. And good bacteria wipe out antibiotic pathogens, according to the latest study also. Good bacteria into your diet on hopefully a daily basis, and that study was published in Infection and Immunity. So if you have had to take antibiotics, and it does wipe out the good bacteria, and end up with some antibiotic reactions, take good bacteria 3 to 5 times a day, and it will help. New good bacteria. That's important. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and living. We are 17 minutes in the program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Now going to Stanford University, where Professor William Dershowitz is explaining to a group of why they were told go to an Ivy League school, including initially Stanford, to become a leader. It's expected of you. You know, let the people who go to state universities or more obscure colleges and universities, of which are the United States, be the worker bees of society, but you have a special plateau. You're going to be on overseeing everything. Well, that's what a lot of people believe, and that's kind of the message, and that's what's inferred. He offers a difference of opinion. He is in the middle of a lecture. Let's hear what he has to say for about 5 minutes.
I don't think I need to tell any of you that leadership, the word leadership, has become one of the central, maybe the central buzzword in elite education. When you were applying to Stanford, you were told that Stanford was looking for leaders. You demonstrated your leadership by being the head of something, or even better, starting something. Didn't matter what. You just knew you had to do it. And now you're here. You're constantly being told you're a leader, 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 leader. What does that mean? I think the charitable interpretation of the meaning of leadership as it's used at Stanford and everywhere else is that it means nothing whatsoever. Empty, just a completely empty term. Probably the truer explanation is that it means clawing your way to the top. It's a polite word for self-aggrandizement. So I'm going to read you just a few pages, a few pieces from that chapter on leadership. Leadership had meaning once among America's elite, and I'm talking about the pre-meritocratic, waspy, upper-class, Ivy League thing, like Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt. Duty, honor, courage, toughness, graciousness, selflessness, These were aristocratic values, and they came with all the reprehensible aristocratic attitudes we're now so good at condescending to. But that doesn't make them any less commendable. Leadership had content for these fortunate sons of the upper class. The concept made demands. It meant devotion to the benefit of others, not yourself. It called for allegiance to ideals, a commitment to the stewardship of institutions, a code of public service that was something more than a commencement afterthought. The country was being placed in their care, and they were expected to hand it on in better shape than they'd received it. So what does leadership require? Some of you may also have seen, there's another essay of mine from a talk that I gave at West Point called Solitude and Leadership that's circulated a lot, where I talk about how leadership begins in the way you develop yourself, in courage and imagination, moral courage and moral imagination. I quote this in the book. I don't have a quote at my fingertips. Mark Edmondson, professor at University of Virginia, who writes really beautifully about higher ed, also talks about leadership, and he says that on college campuses, being a leader means being a very good follower. It means doing what the adults want you to do. It's being like a miniature adult who's always trying to please the big adults, which is exactly how you've been raised your entire lives. So I say, actually, the crucial task is to create a self, which is what I said college is for. And I define a self as something there that, when the world pushes against you, is capable of pushing back. In other words, being a leader takes a willingness. It's not about being popular. It's about being willing to be unpopular. Okay. But the problem is that kids today are raised not only in an atmosphere of constant affirmation, or I should say one of the problems, but also amidst the relentless inculcation of pro-social behavior. We urge them to be team players. We teach them to be cheerful, flexible, and conciliatory, to always seek consensus and compromise. So intent have we become on avoiding painful feelings, both within ourselves and amongst ourselves, so committed to group harmony, so vigilant against offense, exclusion, confrontation, and other aspects of being human, that we've ended up with kids whose edges have been sanded off. Andrew Del Banco, Columbia professor, another great writer on higher ed, in a different connection, he's actually talking about Catcher in the Rye, he said that the dissident impulse, the impulse to say no, was always traditionally a very powerful one in American society. That's what Holden does. He says no to society. But it's hard to see much trace of that today. Not even among the young, and certainly not among the young on selective college campuses. Students now no longer seem to make the kind of fundamental demand upon society, that is, for a different world, that would once have been seen as a matter of course. Let me quickly add, before I sound like too much of an old fart, that when I say now, students now don't do it, I mean the last 40 years, starting around the time I got to college in 81. To question everything, to melt the world down in thought and to seek to reforge it anew was seen for the better part of two centuries as the privilege and indeed the duty of being young. No longer. The 60s were not the exception. We are the exception.
Okay, let's recap what he said. Sorry, the volume was just a little low there for a while. He's saying that the illusion of what we anticipate, all these young, highly motivated students going to Ivy League schools, Harvard, Yale, Pennsylvania, University of Chicago, we expect not to be leaders. You don't think of someone from SUNY or a state university of going out and being a leader. Now, but he says, what does all this mean? It means nothing. It's a concept that is not actualized. But there was a time in the 1920s and 30s where there was the idea that if you were Franklin Roosevelt or Teddy Roosevelt, his cousin, that you were expected to be responsible when you had a position of authority. You were to sustain that prosperity, and you had to leave the job better than when you found it. People had to be better off. You had to make improvements, and you had to make self-sacrifice to do it. And there was a certain coterie of honor that you were above being bought. You were above being influenced. You were above ideology. Now, that's never really been the case. unless you went back to Cicero and some of the earlier Romans who fought against the Caesars, because their lack of ideals and their lack of care about the common person. But there have always been those who've served in different capacities who have maintained that. I'll give you one example. This may seem minor, but to me, I've always remembered this. I grew up in a hometown, as many of you have, and if it wasn't a hometown, it was a neighborhood within a town, and that's where a lot of your values came from. What was the consensus thought among your neighbors about behavior? When you acted out beyond a certain point of being rambunctious and curious and adventurous, if you did something that was considered unacceptable, not just your parents were paying attention to it, but everyone else was as well. So we were all part of an extended family, aunts, uncles, and they all had some measure of input upon us. I remember on Sundays, the Sunday meal would be always at my uncle. He was kind of the titular head of all of our family, and he was a quiet man. He was a big man, and he was an engineer, and all my uncles were engineers. And so they would be in the main dining room, and all of us younger ones would be in the kitchen. And afterwards, we'd go to the movies. They'd give us a quarter, and we'd go to the movies and come back. We didn't have to be guarded. Nobody locked their doors. No one was out on the street, intimidating or threatening anyone. And while we were gone, while they were playing canasta, they just would casually comment upon anything that they felt was relevant to improving our character. And so then it was up to the person who was most responsible for us, our immediate parents, to instill that. So in effect, everyone in the family was telling how to improve someone's behavior or actions or attitude, and it worked. I mean, it really worked. We had no suicide. We had no gang warfare. We had no looting. We had no one bullying anyone. And that's the way it was, because we shared some common ideas. And those are wanting today. I remember there was a guy named Billy Mildren, and he lived up the street. We had a little house, about 1,100 square feet. Every time I go back, I go to visit. And the person in that house, and we all were in that, my whole family, and it was crowded, but so what? Billy lived on Covert Street, which is just three blocks away from Covert Street. We all went to the same high school. We all went to the same churches. We all had the same basic social structure. No one was excluded. But Billy's father was in the banking business, and on that street, and a lot of other people whose fathers were lawyers, they were kind of running the town. And there was always stability. Now, because he was a friend, and we played basketball up at his place, I always had a chance to hear what they were talking about. And once I asked, who are these people who run our community? And Mr. Mildren says, the elders, the men and women who care about you and the future, our job is to make sure you have a future. It's also our responsibility to make sure that we care about everyone in our town. And indeed, they did. And if there was ever anything that was needed, the person in the church would tell the minister, and the minister would then know who was a plumber, who was an electrician, who had what skills, and go over to this person's house and fix it. Now, I know that personally because my mother worked as helped run the First Christian Church, did all the work for the pastor, and was always contacting someone to fix something for someone. No one paid for that. You were a good neighbor. You did what was expected. And I felt blessed growing up in a community. They cared enough about each other, but they cared far more than what I'd anticipated. Then I thought about U.S. Steel and IBM later, and before I went to nutrition school and got degrees, I graduated from business schools. And in one of my classes, I was asking Professor Dixon about, well, who are these people that run U.S. Steel and IBM and Xerox and the big companies? And he thought for a moment, and he said, these are the people that you have multiple generations of families in a community able to sustain a quality of life because they know that they can spend their entire career from the time they enter the workforce to the time they retire with benefits and pensions at one company. And I thought about that. And I said, wow, we never heard about the people running companies for a simple reason. Their job was to maintain stability and growth and protect the interest of the community. All that changed in the 1970s when the dynamic aggressive life energies, those people who had been running companies for generations to the betterment of communities, began to agree to sell interest to others who would give them large chunks of money, the corporate buyout people, corporate takeover artists, the green mailers, in which case now providing jobs, a stable economy, was no longer the priority. And as a result, we began the ghettoization of America. And then it began to gain steam under Reagan, and it really went full throttle, taking off under Clinton. As of today, over 100,000 corporations have closed down, either gone out of business or moved to another company, so that a small group of people, equity partners and hedge fund people, can make money. Because why make a bicycle or a refrigerator or a car where you've been doing it successfully for 100 years in the United States when you can do it for one-tenth the price in China or Bangladesh? But what about all those people? What about the people who said they didn't have to go to college because they knew that there was three jobs for every person who needed one, and they could spend their whole life there and generally did? Generations would work there. Well, those people were no longer a part of the calculus. What if it provided no money for the people to keep up their infrastructures? And too bad. So if you want to know how we got here, it's when the dynamic aggressive stopped being the steward and became the opportunist. And that will not reverse. That will not change. Unfortunately, and I gave a lecture last day. I wished I would have recorded it because it was a three-hour lecture on the nature of greed. And how do people get to a point where they don't no longer attach, they can detach from the consequences of their actions, even when it's apparent and palpable that other people will suffer because of their actions. So I talked about a deeper element of the human dynamic of insecurity and what insecure people will do. And almost all politicians and people seeking success and power are insecure. So that is something that he was saying there. I just wanted to feed on that a little bit, give you a little broader perspective. Now, we're going, and by the way, Goldman Sachs, last week, the chairman of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, talked about, is curing patients a sustainable business model? The answer, no. So just imagine the people who really had the power, the bankers, and especially Goldman Sachs, they don't want cures. They want you to be on a drug forever, multiple drugs, because they frequently have put the investments into the drug companies or the acquisition of drugs where they can control the patents and increase the prices by thousands of percent. But he's actually gone on record now. Quote, is curing patients a sustainable business model? No. Okay. Now you know. And that's why you should not have anything to do with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo. You should put your money in and support these small savings loans and the union banks instead of the big behemoths that don't care about you. Now let's go to another audio clip. And this audio clip is important because you rarely have a chance to hear Edward Snowden today. He's kind of off the radar. But this is a short 3-minute segment about Facebook is a surveillance company rebranded as social media.
Today's alternative news channel, your daily source for up-to-the-minute breaking alternative news. Here's what's happening.
Snowden, Facebook is a surveillance company rebranded as social media. According to one former CIA employee, Facebook is not the pure and innocent social playground it's parading around pretending to be. No, according to NSA mouthpiece and former government official Edward Snowden, Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook empire's true purpose is not what we believe it to. Snowden went on the record claiming that the world's most popular social network is nothing but a surveillance company masking itself as something that it is not, and if Snowden is to be believed, we are all being watched by the big men in charge behind the scenes. Snowden took to a different social platform, the much more bare-bones but equally recognizable Twitter, to state that Facebook make their money by collecting and selling detailed records of private lives that were once plainly described as surveillance companies. A bold claim, for certain, but far from uncharted waters for someone such as Snowden. While the comments from the NSA informant may come as a surprise to some and have some shock value on the surface, Snowden certainly isn't the first in a position of power to call out Facebook, and numerous other Silicon Valley properties, for their shady practices. Back in 2014, author Julian Assange criticized Silicon Valley powerhouse Google for similar practices in a book titled When Google Met WikiLeaks. Snowden believes that social media as we know it comes with close ties to the United States government, and he's determined to get to the bottom of it. A noble cause, without question. Perhaps retired AT&T communications specialist Mark Klein said it the best in a 2006 interview with Wired magazine when he went on record to state that these companies are collecting on everybody. If true, it's a worrisome reality to say the least, but it's a bold claim for any man to make publicly without sufficient evidence and belief to back it up. Is Snowden onto something with his recent tirade, or is he simply spewing hogwash? Time will tell what becomes of his efforts, but it's something to keep an eye on going forward, particularly if you're one of Facebook's hundreds of millions of users who find themselves mining the website in their spare time on a day-to-day basis. Let this serve as a friendly reminder to think twice about what kind of information you're sharing online. You might not want every little detail about you out there for all eyes to see.
Today's alternative.
Okay. Now let's go. So Snowden, I watched the interview he did, which was over an hour, but he's saying everything you write, everything you search, every keystroke you make, they have every word in every phone call, every cell phone line, they have a record of it. And they were supposed to put all these computers focused upon only foreign communication to see if they could find someone who is plotting any attacks against America. To the opposite, they put it all upon Americans, covering every single action of every American. And even Google has been tracking you, has enormous files on every single person, can tell for a year back every single place you visited, went, because when you carry your cell phone, it's recording where you're going. There's electronic trail. So if you take a bus ride, a plane ride, it has it. And also remember, when you have a cell phone on you, it can turn on and record the conversation that you're having. So just remember that. Now we're going to hear a short piece, 5-minute piece from John Pilger about World War III already underway.
Three forces since World War II, led by the United States, is taking place along Russia's western frontier. Not since Hitler invaded the Soviet Union have foreign troops presented such a demonstrable threat to Russia. Ukraine, once part of the Soviet Union, has become a CIA theme park. Having orchestrated a coup in Kiev, Washington effectively controls the regime that's next door and hostile to Russia, a regime rotten with Nazis, literally. Prominent parliamentary figures in the Ukraine are the political descendants of the notorious anti-Semitic OUN and a UPA fascists. They openly praise Hitler and call for the persecution and expulsion of the Russian-speaking minority. That's not what you read, of course, in the news. In Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, on Russia's frontier, the US military is permanently deploying combat troops, tanks, weapons. Now, this extreme provocation of the world's second nuclear power, Russia, is met with silence in the West, especially in Australia, the most silent of all, the land of willful ignorance. What makes the prospect of nuclear war even more dangerous is a parallel campaign, propaganda campaign, against China. Seldom a day passes when China is not elevated to the status of a threat. Count the American admirals who fly in with their scare stories about China. Each is given unctuous, uncritical front-page treatment. According to Admiral Harry Harris, the Pacific commander, China is, and I quote, building a great wall of sand in the South China Sea. What he's referring to is China building airstrips in the Spratly Islands, which are the subject of a dispute with the Philippines, a dispute of little consequence until Washington pressured and bribed the government in Manila, and Admiral Harris launched a propaganda campaign called Freedom of Navigation. What does this mean? It means freedom for American warships to patrol and intimidate and dominate the coastal waters of China. Try to imagine the American reaction if Chinese warships did the same off the coast of California. I made a film called The War You Don't See, in which I interviewed distinguished journalists in America and Britain, reporters such as Dan Rather of CBS, Raggy Omar, the BBC, David Rose of The Observer. All of them said that had journalists and broadcasters done their job and questioned the propaganda that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, had they not amplified and echoed the lies of George W. Bush and Tony Blair, the invasion of Iraq might not have happened, and hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children would be alive today. The propaganda laying the ground for a war against Russia and China is no different in principle, but a lot more dangerous. Name a single journalist in Australia, an academic, a politician of any party, who has publicly and vociferously asked why China is building airstrips in the South China Sea. The answer ought to be glaringly obvious. The United States is encircling China with a network of bases, ballistic missiles, battle groups, nuclear-armed bombers. This lethal arc extends from right here in Australia to the islands of the Pacific, the Marianas, the Marshalls and Guam, to the Philippines, Thailand, Okinawa, Korea, and right across Eurasia to Afghanistan and India and Pakistan. Look at the map. America has hung a noose around the neck of China. Australia, in America's pocket, is beckoning war with our greatest trading partner. Incredibly, none of this is news. Censorship by omission, silence by media, then war by media. In 2015, in high secrecy, Washington and Canberra staged the biggest single air-sea military exercise in history, known as Talisman Sabre. Its aim was to rehearse an air-sea battle plan, blocking sea lanes such as the Straits of Malacca and the Lombok Straits, that cut off China's access to oil, gas, and other vital materials from the Middle East and Africa. Silence. In the circus known as the American presidential campaign, Donald Trump is being presented as a lunatic, a fascist. He's certainly odious, but he's also a media hate figure, and that alone should arouse our skepticism. Trump's views on migration are grotesque, but no more grotesque than those of David Cameron or Tony Abbott or a couple of serving ministers in the current Turnbull government.
We'll bring it down. Just wanted to share a little bit of this talk he's gave. Share more in upcoming programs. But you never hear of John Pilger. And he is just, he is the top, one of the top three journalists in the world. And he is persona non grata in the United States in the media. They won't have him on because he won't compromise on the truth. And talking about the truth, more and more people are coming forward now saying that Assad did not bomb or poison his own people. In fact, the first journalist, who was one of the best journalists in the world from England, actually went to the hospital, an underground hospital, and the doctors told him yesterday, a little audio clip, I'll play that audio clip for you tomorrow. We're just trying to refresh the clip because it's so low, the one that I was able to pull off the internet, that you can't hear it. But it's a minute, 25-second clip, and what the journalist is saying is that I'm here in the hospital, and they're saying no gas attack. There were no sarin gas, not even chlorine gas. What did happen was American bombs and missiles were dropped nearby, causing enormous of dust, and the children were brought in because they were suffering from inhalation of dust, and that's what was happening, but there was nothing else. And so that's the first journalist on the scene telling us this. Then we have two ex-British ambassadors questioning the claim that ordered chemical attack, as these, Greg Murray, who I'm trying to have on next week, and Peter Ward. And they doubt that this happened, the chemical attacks, and they urge U.S. government not to rush into war without proof. Now, they've already, May, who is prime minister, is about the female equivalent of John Bolton without the mustache. She has the same really bulldog, aggressive, pro-war, pro-militarism, pro-oligarch agenda. That's what she's like. And you have former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, and he was speaking in a very big debate on the BBC radio Scotland, and he believes the reported chemical attack in Douma may not have been committed by Assad. And the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is there on the ground now. And no one is finding that there was this attack. It was all reported by the White Helmets. And my goodness, where is the media, left and right, exposing the White Helmets and the person who founded them, and the governments who've supported them? This is a terrorist organization, not a word. So we will be having the first person who was at the hospital, this outstanding journalist, on our program. We're making arrangements now. You will be the first to hear the audio clip of his interview from the war zone, from the hospital. All this is nonsense. But here we went. We went rushing into damage without having an investigation to verify its legitimacy. So, and I want to say a few words. And in fact, I'm going to share some of the thoughts of Teachout from The Guardian on Mark Zuckerberg. He testified last week, and I believe it was an utter sham, as do others. And when he testified last Tuesday, according to the UN, quote, the energy in the room and on Twitter was electric. At last, the reluctant CEO was made to answer some questions, except it failed. It was designed to fail. It was a show designed to get Zuckerberg off the hook after a number of hours in Washington, D.C. It was a show that gave the pretense of a hearing without a real hearing. It was designed to deflect and confuse. Each senator was given less than 5 minutes for questions. That meant that there was no room for follow-ups, no chance for big discoveries, and many frustratingly half-developed ideas. Compare that to Bill Gates' hearing on Microsoft, where he faced lawyers and staff for several days, or the Kefauver hearings, which were over a year. By design, you can't do a hearing of this magnitude in just a couple of hours. The worst moments of the hearing for us as citizens were when senators asked if Zuckerberg would support legislation that would regulate Facebook. I don't care whether Zuckerberg supports honest ads or privacy laws or the GDPR. By asking him if he would support legislation, the senators elevated him to a kind of co-equal philosopher king whose view on Facebook regulation carried special weight. Shouldn't. Facebook is a known behemoth. Corporately, it has exposed at least 87 million people's data, informed propaganda, and perpetuated discrimination. We shouldn't be begging for Facebook's enactment of laws or for Mark Zuckerberg's promises of self-regulation. We should treat him as a danger to democracy and demand our senators get a real hearing. Tim from New Jersey, you're on live.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Tim.
How are you?
Good. Please share what you called in for.
Something else came to mind besides the mentioning what I want to say about Facebook is that isn't this a reminding of the nature of Goebbels? I believe it was among the Third Reich Nazi propaganda people. You repeat the lie enough times.
That wasn't Goebbels, that was Edward Bernay, from which a lot of people around the world, including the Nazis, including Hermann Goering, the Air Force Luftwaffe head, Hitler, all of them used tell the lie enough times, have enough authority, figures tell the lie on your behalf, and have institutions tell the lie, and the people will believe it. Weapons of mass destruction, not just Fox and the New Republic, but also all of the liberal stations got on board until it was, wow, isn't this great what we're doing? Well, it wasn't. But yes, you are correct, Tim. Tell the big lie and people will believe it. Last call, Craig from the Bronx. Craig, your turn.
Hi, Rick Bronx.
Yes, you're on the air.
Pilger proves what Victor Perlo wrote in his book, American Imperialism, published in the 1950s, that at the end of World War II, the U.S. government decided on world hegemony in order to maximize the profits of its corporations, backed up with war. War was necessary to enforce U.S. imperialism that has existed, worldwide U.S. imperialism that has existed from 1945 at the end of World War II until today.
You are absolutely correct, and I thank you for calling in and reminding us of that. We are posturing against Russia, Iran, and China in such a way that it could lead to a nuclear confrontation. And no one wins when that happens except the big industrialists who profit from the war machine. And people should be paying attention, and journalists should be challenging the administration for this posturing, but they're not, because they're unfortunately propagandists for this administration and the last. I appreciate you calling in and taking your thoughts to our audience. Thank you very much. We're out of time, everyone. Please listen tonight, 7 o'clock. I've got a dynamite show with two phenomenal guests talking on issues that are relevant to you. Have a nice day, everyone.
should the